Our third panelist is Robert Scheer. Robert is the author of Star Warriors. He is the editor-in-chief of Truthdig and has built a reputation for strong social and political writing over his 30 years as a journalist. His talk today is called The Madness Persists.
I keep telling Helen I didn't write Star Warriors. I wrote a book called With Enough Shovels, Reagan, Bush, and Nuclear War, but it's okay. I want to say something. One reason I raced here from the West Coast is I'll do anything Helen Caldicott tells me to do. And I particularly respect what she did on this issue. And I think we're falling into a bit of a trap here now if we assume that adults are watching the store, that rational people are considering the use of these weapons and different strategies. And she showed us they were actually being very foolish. And my own work happened to correspond to that at the time. I was a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and one of my obligations was to interview presidential candidates. And I was interviewing H. Walker Bush when he was first running for the 1980 election. He had won the Iowa primary. He was full of confidence. The two of us were in a small plane. And I was challenging the basic arms race. What do you need more of these weapons? What are you going to do with them? And he looked at me and he said, well, that only makes sense if you don't believe nuclear war is winnable. And I knew I had a great story and that the man was being a fool. And he, after all, had been head of the CIA, been ambassador to China, and his whole competitive edge over Ronald Reagan and others, that he was supposed to be very knowledgeable and expert, and Reagan was supposed to be out to lunch on most questions. Well, it turned out to be not the case, and Bush made this rather insane statement about winnable nuclear war, and we pursued the topic a bit, and it really hurt him in the election, and in fact, that's probably the main reason he didn't get it that time. And it was my introduction to this world. I then went on to interview Reagan. He was a little bit better at that time. He got worse after. And I also was covering the labs a bit for the LA Times. And my basic topic here is, it goes back to George Washington's farewell address. We always refer to Eisenhower, that other great general, who made a very similar comment. But in George Washington's farewell address, he warned us about the impostures of pretended patriotism. It was part of his warning about foreign entanglements, not an uncommon theme for the founders. The basic image driving the foreign policy view of the founders was the collapse of the Roman Empire, the Spanish Empire, the French Empire, and the English Empire, which they were hoping to bring about and had helped. And the whole idea was that to create a republic, a representative republic, was incompatible with building an empire. Because if you build an empire, as we all know, in war and so forth, you sacrifice truth, you sacrifice the key ingredient of a representative republic, an informed public, that so their vote means something because they have knowledge and information. And that basically the march to empire is the march to lying, deceit, and distortion. And, of course, that's what we saw clearly during the Cold War period. And, of course, surrounds the whole discussion of nuclear weapons. We weren't even told that our leading general at that time, Eisenhower, was against dropping the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We weren't let in on any of the debates about it, the wisdom of it, the intent, or the fact that peace was about to break out, and maybe one reason for dropping it was to prevent the Russians or Soviets from participating in the occupation of Japan, because after all, the wartime agreements had said they would enter 90 days after the victory in Europe. So there were all these other considerations. We as a public were never involved in the wisdom of that decision, the ethics, or really the choices, the decisions, so forth. And so that has been true of all of the major debates. And the way you keep the lid on and keep the public out is with classification, secrecy, and so forth. And I do want to have, I wanted to, before I forget the point, I do want to disagree with the last notion that it's racism, because I would point out to people that in the middle of the madness of going to war with Iraq, which had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack, and it was one of the few places in the Mideast where al-Qaeda could not operate at all, it was under Saddam Hussein in Iraq, but in our need to get allies for this effort, we turned our back on our concern about brown people in Pakistan, who are rather fanatical about their religion, which we blame for every ill in the world today, developing the bomb under their scientist Khan, right? And actually, they were the source for the North Korean Iranian and Libyan efforts. Pakistan, brown people. So we suddenly decided it was okay for Pakistan to have the bomb, quite a few of them by now, and also to have delivery system because we supplied some airplanes that were capable of delivering. So what I'm suggesting is that irrationality underrides it always, including the irrational. I mean, even racism would be too rational for the policy. We, in fact, make partners all over the world that contradict everything we claim. But the way it keeps operating, and it's with all foreign policy decisions, but certainly the question of nuclear war fighting, has to do with classification and the darkest secrets. And it is not true, by the way, that no lab director would quit over the stuff not working. Roy Woodruff actually was fired over it because he objected publicly to the claims being made for Star Wars when he was the director of the Livermore Lab. I interviewed him at the time for the LA Times. He was quite clear why he was forced out. So let me just visit that chapter and visit my to make my case about our deliberate exclusion from all this. After I interviewed Bush, and then I went on to interview Reagan, and Reagan himself was getting really enamored with the Star Wars idea. Remember what Star Wars was. It was an effort to find a way to actually use these weapons, because clearly they were not usable in any serious sense once other people had them, particularly the Soviets. And the whole thing of Star Wars, if you've forgotten, was really to have a Buck Rogers application of this thing. You would be harnessed the power of the bomb in space, and you would shoot out an infinite number of death-dealing rays, right, that could shoot down all the incoming missiles. So you could have first strike capability, and you would certainly have the ultimate defensive thing, shoot down all of their MIRVed missiles. And it was based on the idea of harnessing the power of the nuclear explosion to get this lasing effect, all right? And the guy who was behind it was Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb, and he was the big power at Livermore. And he had a young scientist named Lowell Wood and a bunch of other guys, and these guys were all gangbusters. And they were fools, by the way, when it came to discussing politics or the world or geography or anything else. And one of the things I discovered as a journalist, and I had a history of being concerned in the anti-war movement and everything else, that didn't stop. When the government wants to leak to you, they don't check your credentials too carefully. And leaking is the name of the game. 95 or 98% of the news we get about foreign affairs, about war and peace, about nuclear, are deliberately leaked, classified, secret information. It's all the time. It's endless. The only people who go to jail for it or get singled out are the people who leak information that doesn't make the administration look good. But if they want to tell their story, they'll leak the darkest secrets. So let me just give you a case in point. Reagan got enamored with Star Wars. Reagan became president. $100 billion was spent on it. And we're going to harness this thing. So I'm going to read a scene, because sometimes I think I make this stuff up. It's so crazy. So I, sorry, I lost it now. Let me see if I can, well, I was going to read a scene, but if I'm challenged, I'll read it when I sit down. So I wrote about this stuff and everything. I went to the lab, and it was interesting. Suddenly, I could be anywhere in the lab because I was covering this, And I, just as an example, many years later, Wen-Ho Lee would serve 9 months in solitary confinement because he supposedly leaked secrets to a foreign government, first the Chinese, and everything. And it all ended up, the charges were thrown out by a wonderful Reagan-appointed judge. But the fact is, the real charge had to do with a bunch of computer coding that somehow was in the wrong room on the wrong computer. And I wrote at the time, and that's where this article is, when I was doing Livermore back earlier with Lowell Wood and Teller and all these people, I was there at 3, 4 in the morning eating pizza with these guys in the most secure area. And they were using this computer code and stuff to prop open doors. And no one was concerned about great state secrets or anything else because they were spinning their tail. And it was a bunch of guys having fun. And they were going to conquer the world and free it and liberate it and, you know, lunacy and so forth. Anyway, one day I'm on this plane, it's now Southwest, but I think it was PSA back there in 1985, and I'm on a plane, and I happen to be a member of this arms control study group that Sid Rell and Wolfgang Panofsky had up at Stanford. Condoleezza Rice was in the group, and I think Ted Postel, who spoke here, was in the group. And so I was on my way up, and I run into Edward Teller getting off the same plane. And we were friends. I met him, interviewed him. I mean, we're getting along. And Edward Teller said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going up to the arms control group at Stanford." He says, "Oh," he said, "make sure Sidrell was a Jason. He had the highest security clearance. He knew what was going on." He said, "Make sure Sid tells you the great results we got on the cottage test." Now, they named these nuclear tests after cheeses at that point. So this was the cottage cheese test. Now, the idea that this test was even dealing with the X-ray laser was a really big secret. The idea that they got what Teller implied to me was lasing was the most important secret you could have in the world at that time. That the United States had cracked this scientific problem and was going to be able to set out an infinite number of charges in space and take out any incoming missile and have dominance with nuclear power and do a first strike, if that was your goal, was the most important secret, was the thing the Soviets would most want to know, anyone would most want to know. Here is Edward Teller telling me this somewhere between the Hertz stand and baggage claim at the San Jose airport. And he's telling me, "Yeah, we got great results. We got lazy. Make sure Sid tells you all about it." So, and I had a tape recorder. I'm interviewing him. So, okay. I go up there. Sid Rell is a marvelous person. I knock, say, Galvez House, Stanford. And Sid comes to me. I said, "Hey, I ran into Edward Teller out at the airport. He says you're going to tell me all about the lasing they got at the cottage test." Sid Rell turns white. He says, "Outside." We go for a walk. He says, "What the hell are you talking about?" He said, "Edward told you what?" He said, "You can't talk about this stuff. Do you know, I'm not going to talk. You know, what are you, entrapping?" You know, he was really legitimately crazed because, after all, this was this big secret, okay? Well, it turned out that Edward Teller was wrong. A few years later, we find out, after he's convinced the president that this stuff works, they spend a lot more money, we find out that they knew quite early that the test results were false, that the impact of the explosion had distorted the measuring machines, and they didn't get lasing. And Roy Woodruff, who was head of the lab, knew it. And so that was the real story. They didn't get it. And the X-ray laser was never going to work. And so the whole idea of Star Wars was a fraud. Was not going to happen. Okay? So there you have it. The use of secrecy to put out this story that's positive to their effort, and then the denial of reality and throw somebody in jail if they had told me the truth. Okay? That would have been a whistleblower. And Obama, who's jailed 3 under the Espionage Act more than all other presidents before, would have been the one who would throw him in jail. Let me fast forward. You got Wen-Ho Lee. And Wen-Ho Lee, scientist at Los Alamos, who, you know, they kept depicting as this great Chinese spy, but neglecting to mention he was from Taiwan, neglecting to mention that he was very anti-communist. And what happened? Christopher Cox, who went on to screw up the banking system when he was head of the Security and Exchange Commission, was this hawk in Congress, Chris Cox from Irvine. And Chris Cox, they had a committee, and they were investigating leaks under Bill Clinton to the Chinese. And there was this big story, and Richardson was Secretary of Energy, big story about how the figuring out the W-88 warhead for the miniaturization, you know, nuclear, that had been given to the Chinese by a spy at Los Alamos, okay? And it was a bogus story on the face, okay? But the New York Times ran with it. How did they get the story? And it was Jeff Gerth and James Risen, two very good journalists. But, you know, it's pretty hard to resist a leak right after. And so the New York Times had it on the front page. At first, they didn't mention Wen Ho Lee, but they had this Chinese spy, so forth. In fact, the government never accused Wen Ho Lee of being a spy for any specific government because they couldn't figure out which government he might. He didn't even like going to China. He preferred Italian opera. He hated Chinese music. And it turned out the only times he went to China is when his wife, who was working in a clerical position at Los Alamos, was recruited to go on the trips with the scientists because she was fluent in Mandarin. And she can interpret what the Chinese scientists were saying to each other at their meetings. And so Wen Ho Lee was schlepped along on these trips. That was the reality. Well, when I went to report the story, all the guys I knew at Los Alamos said that was bogus, that technology is something that they wouldn't have gotten from us. He didn't work on it. So all the people who knew him knew it was bogus. They milked that story. They kept the guy in solitary confinement for 9 months, lights on 24/7. When he went to the bathroom, he was a very shy guy. They photographed him. They treated him as the worst evil person in the world. And after going 9 months through all this and looking at all the evidence, a Reagan-appointed judge, I was in the courthouse in Albuquerque when it happened, and this Reagan-appointed judge said, Mr. Lee, the government, the executive branch, the judiciary, the Congress owe you an apology. And I want to apologize on behalf of the government. And Wen Ho Lee was released. Now, the reason I tell you that long story is because we right now are in a situation, this is what my current book is about, They Know Everything About You, where in the name of fighting another devil syndrome, it's not communism now, it's terrorism, which we treat as an undifferentiated menace, okay? That was the whole trick with communism, right? There weren't two communist governments in the world that got along. One, two, okay? The Tito Yugoslav example was the right one, okay? When the Russians and Chinese communists were firing at each other across the border, the Sino-Soviet dispute had started in the 1920s, but we kept this fiction, the media, the government, the secrecy, everything, that somehow there was a monolithic, unified communist enemy out there. And in order to defeat it, we had to sacrifice civil liberties, we had to spend an enormous amount of money, we had to intervene in places like Vietnam, or the dominoes would fall and they would be in San Diego. The war ends in an ignominious defeat for the United States, all right? And what happens? The Vietnamese don't invade San Diego, they go to war with communist China. Two communist countries, one was supposed to be backing the others, go to war. Now, we would have known all that if we had the Pentagon Papers, that Daniel Ellsberg faced 130 years in jail for trying to give to us. Secrecy again, classification. We should have known it if we just read a couple of books that were around already. But the fact of the matter is, this most absurd depiction of the outside world, of the danger, of the threat, the justification for killing 3.5 million Indo-Chinese people, 59,000 American troops, was all based on classification and secrecy, and the public kept deliberately ignorant about that. What Senator Fulbright, who pushed through the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, said had he been able to read the Pentagon Papers, he never would have voted for the thing, let alone carry it. So if you look at this right up through the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, again, the New York Times falling for government leaks, government lies. That's what Judy Miller was all about, right? And they telling you the darkest, the deepest secrets, you know, and painting a picture. And anybody who challenged it, they're a suspect. They go to jail. They get challenged. So what I'm trying to suggest is to treat this apparatus of the national security state as if it's on any level acting in a rational sense, other than trying to have an enemy so we can have a big defense industry, the military-industrial complex, to assume on any other level has to do with deterrence, the enemy, is utter nonsense. We don't have adults watching the store. And where we are now, and I'm going to run out. How much time do I have left? Do I know? Hello? 5 minutes. All right, let me stretch it out then. where we are now is a particularly dangerous moment. Because if you saw the movie Selma, you saw the effort to destroy Martin Luther King, right? And, you know, there's some people saying, oh, it wasn't a perfect movie because it didn't give Lyndon Johnson his due credit and civil rights. Well, if Lyndon Johnson deserves any credit, why the hell didn't he get Hoover off King's back when he was trying to drive him crazy? And, you know, in fact, what was King's bravest act was denouncing Lyndon Johnson for being, when the U.S. was the major purveyor of violence in the world today, Martin Luther King, Riverside Church. And Lyndon Johnson was out to destroy him. So it's utter nonsense. But we know. Then, yes, the surveillance state had its means. And in fact, when it happens in a society that is not overtly totalitarian, it's more effective. People think their government is benign. They trust it. You know, when I worked in totalitarian societies like the Soviet Union, you knew no one in the old Soviet Union, even if they were fervent communists, believed Pravda told them the truth. None of them thought they were free to express contrary opinions. All of them thought they were being observed. But if you look back at the technology there open, I wrote a piece in 1999 for Yahoo Internet Life on the emerging surveillance state. I said, what we have now is a Stalin or a Hitler's wet dream. We have a degree of observation of the individual that they could never have imagined. And that was before 9/11. After 9/11, it just accelerated, the Patriot Act and everything else. What you have is, first of all, and Professor Chomsky asked me whether the corporation surveillance is worse than the government. Thanks to Edward Snowden, we know they're one and the same. That was the great contribution of Edward Snowden, one of the great heroes of modern history, along with Daniel Ellsberg. And the question you have to ask about Snowden or about Ellsberg is not why they did what they did, you know, Hillary Clinton suggesting he's a traitor because he didn't take advantage of the channels. When she was lying, she knew the whistleblower protection doesn't go for contractors. She knew there was no channels. She knew he'd be thrown in the slammer and silenced, you know, if you're thinking about voting for Hillary Clinton. But the reality is, you know, that the important question is, why was there an Ellsberg or a Snowden? No. There are over a million people had the clearances that Snowden had. There were lots of people who had the clearances that Ellsberg had. Lots of people who read the Pentagon. Lots of people knew what the NSA was doing. The really question you have to ask is, what does it say about us as a people that we have only one Edward Snowden, only one Chelsea Manning? You know, that's what you have to ask. Where are the other people speaking up who care about the Republic, care about... So I just want to conclude by saying we are in a particularly dangerous moment because, first of all, because of consumer sovereignty being the main definition of freedom, most of our population, particularly our younger people, think that shopping is the major act of independence and freedom and citizenship. And so anything that can help you. So even myself today, to get my own bloody quote, I had to give my thumbprint to every security agency in the country. Okay, and can you take my location? You're trying to find a restaurant. Okay, so we have, as a people, turned over a degree of data. If any totalitarian government had ever required it, anybody would know this is evil. Okay, and information that lets people know what book you bought, how far you read in the book, what song you listened. I don't have to go through the whole list. Where you are in every moment, who you're having dinner with, and so forth. Totally destroying the basic principle of this government is that if you don't have individual sovereignty, this is the one thing the founders, for all of their faults or whatever and their prejudices, had. This is why we have a Fourth Amendment. It's why we have the restriction on self-incrimination. It's why we have the First Amendment. If you don't have individual sovereignty, so it's not the population that's treated with suspicion, it's the government that's treated with suspicion. And the guys who gave us those protections were going to be the government. And what Madison and Washington and Jefferson and all those people say is, you better watch us, because power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we don't like the press. We think they're scurrilous. They make up lies about us. We don't like the rabble having meetings. We don't like any of this. But we're going to enshrine the right to those things, right? We're going to enshrine the right to those things, because otherwise we are going to be a menace. We're going to go the way of the Roman Empire. And the way the argument got twisted after 9/11 was freedom became seen as a luxury, something you have when you have no problems. Well, any dictator in the world will take that one. You know, I got a stable dictatorship going. You guys want to yap over there? Be my guest. But the whole idea of individual freedom in this society was supposed to be, it's the free citizens objecting that are the necessary ingredient to having sound governance. That's the idea. And that's what we threw away. You know? And we threw away, and I'm going to end on this because I see people get nervous here. We threw it away again over classification. We still don't know. And if anything you say about this, then suddenly you're seen as a conspiracy nut, okay? But we still know very little about the so-called enemy. Right now, we're in this absolute madness of, you know, ISIS is the new excuse. Where did ISIS come from? Why didn't we know more about it 3 years ago? What did it have to do with the effort to overthrow Assad? Okay, after all, he was made the boogeyman. Then ISIS, okay. What, you know, now ISIS is being seen as standing for all of the Muslim world, okay? And yet, at the same time, we're trying to demonize Iran, right? And so what happened to the Sunni-Shiite dispute? What happened to all the complexity of this world? Why don't we ever mention Indonesia, which has the largest Muslim population? There's never any nuance. There's never any thought. There's never any critical examination. Most of our academics and experts who understand these complexities remain silent. They're opportunists. Careerism trumps everything. So at the end of the day, we're not even in a position to evaluate, well, what is this terrorist enemy? But we do know one thing. There is not a stated example from the government of where getting this haystack of all of our information to find the needles was necessary. The one case that Obama came up with, Mindar in San Diego, was living at the house of an FBI informant, was under the observation of the CIA, had a full record, and if you want to know who he's calling in Yemen, AT&T would have given him that information in 1 minute. There is not one example. However, we know that the needles that they keep talking about, the people who did the bombing in Boston, the people who did the Charlie Hebdo bombing in Paris, were well known. The one in Paris, he's already served time. All you needed was some old-fashioned, half-drunk cop to check him out. You know, we are now subject to an absolute garbage description. Last point, and then they can yank me. But I started out as an editor of Ramparts magazine back in the 60s, okay? And our first big story was showing how the CIA had infiltrated the National Student Association, cultural organizations that go there. And that created a big scandal. New York Times had a front page, big investigations, ultimately led to the Church Committee report. That is nothing compared to what is now going on between the Pentagon, Silicon Valley, and everything else. Nothing. The same folks who are running DARPA are now working at Google in their special unit, okay? An organization probably many of you never heard about, InQtel. Honestly, how many of you ever heard InQtel? No one in this room. InQtel, it's after a James Bond movie, okay? That is a CIA-funded venture capital company. They're not supposed to be messing around in our domestic life. And that venture capital company has funded some hundreds of organizations in Silicon Valley. And one of them is Palantir. They started it. CIA was Palantir's contract for the first 3 years. And Palantir developed all this wondrous mechanism for mining data. It is now the main data mining organization for all of the intelligence agencies, the New Orleans Police Department, the Los Angeles Police Department, and so forth. So finally, let me just say, we are developing a surveillance state that protects incompetence, protects people who do not respect freedom, and will deny the American people from having that freedom, and will usher in the 1984 Brave New World vision of a population that will self-center itself because it will know it is under constant observation.
All right. Well, yes, we will be doing that after the panel is finished. So thank you for that. We're getting some interesting insights into the system here, and I'm looking forward to the Q&A on this one indeed.